In the summer, I went to the West Bay, to the mountains. And if you hypothetically would not know that there is war in this country, you would not notice. Because you come there and cafes are open, there is music on the streets, there are lively conversations, and it was more of a resort area, of course, where I went. But that was really just also impressive to see these two realities. There is really not a single person in this country who is not affected by this war. But they really find this humor is really a huge instrument of resilience that Ukrainians have, and it kind of helps us also in these dark times.
Das ist die Energie der Gesellschaft. Der Podcast, in dem Wissenschaft, Politik und Gesellschaft aufeinandertreffen. Marina Weisband und Stefan Muschig sprechen mit ihren Gästen über die großen Fragen der Energie- und Klimawende und darüber, wie sie unser tägliches Leben verändern. Und jetzt geht's los.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Energie der Gesellschaft. Ich bin Marina Weisband.
Und ich bin Stefan Muschig. Hallo Marina.
Hi Stefan. Stefan, ich habe eine Frage an dich. Wer ist deine Lieblingsukrainerin in Deutschland, die sich für die Unterstützung der Ukraine und für Demokratiebildung von Jugendlichen einsetzt?
Ich weiß nicht, ob du sie kennst. Sie heißt Marina Weisband.
Das ist deine letzte Antwort?
Naja, es ist ja immer so, dass man soll sich ja immer entscheiden, und eigentlich fällt es schwer. Und es gibt natürlich auch noch etliche andere auf meiner Liste.
Das stimmt. Und ich glaube, ich kenne eine davon. Eine davon ist heute unser Gast.
Ah, ich kenne Anja. Ja, das ist gut. Und ich bin super happy, dass sie heute unser Gast ist und dass wir mit ihr über die Ukraine sprechen.
Genau, wir wollen heute über die Ukraine sprechen, aber auch über, was dieser Krieg bedeutet für Europa und was dieser Krieg bedeutet für die Demokratie. Denn das sind alles Themen, denen sie sich gut auskennt. Und ihr kennt euch schon länger, ne?
Wir kennen uns länger. Wir haben uns persönlich auch gut kennengelernt. Anja arbeitet für das European Youth Parliament, ist da die Direktorin für das gesamte europäische Netzwerk. Und dieses European Youth Parliament, beziehungsweise dessen Arbeit, wird seit vielen Jahren tatsächlich von der E.ON Foundation unterstützt. Und wir sind da in so einer Arbeitsbeziehung. Und gleichzeitig hatte ich das Vergnügen oder das Privileg, auch das eine oder andere persönliche Gespräch mit Anja zu führen über Familien, über das Leben in Berlin und natürlich über die Ukraine. Und da fühle ich mich, in Englisch geht ja manches besser, ne? I feel honored. Ja, das kann man so, das sagt man so auf Englisch so locker dahin, und auf Deutsch klingt es irgendwie blöd, aber es ist tatsächlich so, dass ich über meine Arbeit Menschen kennenlerne, die persönlich, sagen wir mal, weltpolitische, europapolitische Entwicklungen auf so eine ganz andere Ebene bringen können, die es näher an einen heranrückt und die Dringlichkeit mancher Themen dann noch erhöhen. Also das ist mein Verhältnis zu Anja, zu Brunenko.
Ja gut, wir werden auch gleich ins Englische wechseln, damit wir alle ein einfacheres Gespräch führen. Wir werden nachher das Fazit aber auch nochmal auf Deutsch wiederholen am Ende des Podcasts, falls ihr nicht sicher seid, ob ihr alles richtig mitgeschnitten habt. Aber ich würde vorher noch gerne von dir wissen, gibt es etwas, das dich ganz besonders an diesem Gespräch interessiert, was dich umtreibt?
Ja, ganz viel eigentlich, wobei ich mir natürlich auch darüber bewusst bin, wir können jetzt nicht alle Fragen klären, die sozusagen die EU auch nicht klären kann. Also da ist zum Beispiel so eine Frage, warum wird die Ukraine nicht Mitglied der Europäischen Union? Und ich glaube, das ist jetzt nicht das Thema, über das wir hier sprechen können. Vielleicht doch, keine Ahnung. Also das so in Klammern. Aber was mich wirklich interessiert, weil das ist eine Wahrnehmung, die ich über Zeitungslektüre, persönliche Gespräche immer öfter habe, dass wir eigentlich diejenigen sind, die eine Menge von der Ukraine lernen können, auf einer persönlichen Ebene, auf der Ebene von Engagement und Mut, aber vielleicht auch auf technologischer Ebene und auf der Ebene für uns als Stiftung besonders interessant, wie so Gesellschaft und Gemeinschaft, also Zivilgesellschaft, wie auch immer wir es nennen, wie das funktioniert. Ich glaube, da können wir eine Menge von der Ukraine lernen, aber es ist jetzt auch so eine Hypothese. Und ich hoffe, dass wir da ein bisschen tiefer bohren können, wenn wir jetzt ins Gespräch gehen mit Anja.
Mich interessiert auch die Frage nach Resilienz und wie vermitteln wir das an junge Leute und wie vermitteln wir auch diese Begeisterung und diesen Traum, den die Ukraine hat, nach Europa? Wie also können wir das an junge Menschen im Westen vermitteln, die das gewöhnt sind, für die das selbstverständlich ist?
Und vielleicht, also dann, wir haben ja, glaube ich, die Regie sagt immer 5 Minuten für unser Vorgespräch, also wir sind noch nicht ganz um. Vielleicht können wir das auch noch in die Vorrede packen, weil ich glaube, das, was du jetzt gerade gesagt hast, wie können wir das vermitteln? Vielleicht noch einen Schritt weiter gedacht, wie können wir Menschen, die auch vielleicht immer noch ein bisschen zögern, denen die Ukraine immer noch ein bisschen fremd ist und so weiter, wie können wir auch Argumente und vielleicht auch Emotionen dafür liefern, um zu sagen, ja, das ist wichtig, sich mit dem Thema auseinanderzusetzen und es ist am Ende wichtig, die Ukraine zu unterstützen. Ich glaube, das ist ein bisschen auch so eine Entscheidung. Also ich habe das für mich selber, ich habe auch ein bisschen so dialektisch vor Jahren so um das Thema herumgedacht, wie das ja in Deutschland oftmals üblich ist. Und ich vergleiche das immer mit meiner Entscheidung, die Tauben zu lieben. Die sind ja so in den Städten unterwegs und man kann die hassen und sagen, das sind Ratten der Lüfte und die verpesten alles und weg und so, ja so. Oder man sagt, nee, das sind tolle Tiere und wir müssen sie füttern und wir müssen sie achten und so weiter und so fort. Das war für mich wirklich so eine Entscheidung. Ja, ich bin jetzt zum Taubenliebhaber geworden. Und so ist das ein bisschen auch mit der Ukraine. Man muss vielleicht manche Argumente auch beiseite schieben oder bedenken oder was auch immer, ja, und sagen, nein, das ist wirklich ein Thema, das geht uns alle an. Und so, und auf die Art und Weise bin ich so zum Ukraine-Supporter geworden. Ja, also so. Und das ist, glaube ich, etwas, was man natürlich durch das anschaulich machen und das Erzählen von menschlichen Geschichten da auch unterstützen kann. Also das sehe ich auch ein bisschen so für unseren Podcast heute. Nicht als Mission, aber das läuft so mit.
Das ist eine schöne Anekdote. Vor allem funktioniert sie auf so vielen Ebenen. Die Taube als Symbol für den Frieden. Wundervoll. Dann schlage ich vor, holen wir unseren Gast hinzu. I am so happy to welcome Anja Suprunenko. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Anja. So I'm happy to have you in our podcast. I'm happy about having you as a person. I'm happy about having you in your role, professional role. And of course, I'm happy that we discuss in a relevant and interesting topic with you today. So the title of today's podcast is Caught Between War and Modern Democracy, What Can Europe Learn from Ukraine? So this is an ambitious title, but I'm sure you are the proper person to discuss all of it together in this constellation. And so the name of our guest is Anja Suprunenko, born or at least grown up in Chernihiv. It's a large city in the north or northeast of Kyiv, not far from the borders with Russia and Belarus. And before we met, I heard about Chernihiv when the war started. So it was devastating, was what Russians did to your city. Maybe you can tell a little bit more about that, about the situation in Chernihiv. So the city came under heavy fire in the beginning of the war, and it was completely cut off the world. And you had been in Germany before, but parts of your family also came to Germany at this point of time. So this is a very like personal situation that is linked with Chernihiv, the war and the situation in Germany. You hold a bachelor's degree in international economy and management from Kyiv. So what is the name of the Kyiv University?
Kyiv National Economic University.
Okay, thank you. And also a master's degree in public policy from the Hertie School of Governance. That's interesting. In the School of Public Affairs at American University in Berlin and Washington. So I've never heard about this this school or university.
It was just an exchange semester as part of my master's at the Hertie School.
You live in Berlin together with your family, with your husband, and with your 2 children. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Berlin is kind of your part of your home. And what really touched me that you visited Ukraine for the first time since the Russian aggression in August 2025. And as we all know, the war started in February 2022. So that's more than 3 years after the start of the war. Maybe you can tell us about your impressions from your trip to Chernihiv and your country, and what you also are doing. So maybe you can make some advertising and communication around that. You are raising donations for Ukraine. So on social media, this is also something that is worth being mentioned and maybe worth being discussed. Did I miss something?
No, I think personal background, I could also mention a few things, but professional background, of course, that I work as an executive director of European Youth Parliament, and that's a large network for political education in Europe.
Yeah, this is something maybe we can start with before we come to the situation in Chernihiv and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So you are the director for the European Youth Parliament. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard about it before, but maybe not everyone. Maybe you can start with a short introduction of this wonderful network, which I really appreciate. And what is the EYP, and what is the working description of a director of the EYP?
Yeah, no, thanks so much, Stefan, for your kind introduction. It's always impressive what kind of facts people know about me. And good to be here again. Hi, Marina. And EYP, so European Youth Parliament, is the largest network for political education in Europe. We do non-formal education, so we bring young people together in various scenarios all across Europe. So it's not EU-specific, it goes outside of the EU borders, and it's all about young people. So by young people, for young people, that's the slogan we have, and it's, of course, in the background, methodologically, it's all about promoting active citizenship and democracy education. And what my role is, I'm one of very few employees for the network, because otherwise it's all volunteers, and I just try to steer and direct and help and fundraise and just do for European scale partnerships to see how this network could do even better work than we already do with reaching at least 25,000 young people. We reach every year in 40 countries. And that's, of course, it's impressive numbers, but if you do the math and divide it per 40 countries, it actually could really be everywhere, just much more. And in that sense, quantity matters, because the more young people go through the programs that we have to offer, I'm a strong believer that it's just better for Europe. It's a very European-like education that we offer to these young people.
May I ask one question, just one question about these numbers? So we are talking about 40 countries, as we all know. So there are 27 EU members. So is there a tangible difference between EU countries and non-EU countries, and what does it make to you and the network that the director is a woman from Ukraine?
Mm. So we are in Council of Europe countries indeed, and I think in terms of like first question, if there is difference, I think overall young people are universally young, so they're interested in the same topics and passionate about similar things. But of course, I think especially with countries which are more distant from Central Western Europe, I could see that they maybe value opportunities of this kind more, because it's more of a unique opportunity to be in Armenia and to travel to Europe more often and to meet other young people than for a person from France, is more centrally located and is exposed. What it means to the network that there is a Ukrainian woman in charge? I actually never ask my question this. Of course, I hope I'm a good role model, and it is a shift, because there were more German people in charge in my job before. but in the end, everyone did a good job. So symbolically, of course, now for the topic that we will discuss, I think it means something because, of course, I'm personally passionate about the topic. So I hope I could just bring more of this in the daily life of the network.
I was asking since we had a discussion about Europe center and periphery in our last mm-hmm. episode,
Jagoda
Marinic. And so my hypothesis is that a lot of Europe is changing, so that countries from the, let's call it periphery, are getting more into the center. So I appreciate that very much. I find it very important. So therefore, I was interested in your perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Let's maybe a bit later speak on what it means to have countries in the lead for which the idea of a European Union is something new and promising and connected to hope as opposed to just the status quo. But first, since we are in the fourth winter of the war, I would really love to hear from you. What's the situation on the ground right now? What's the situation in the cities? Just because I think many people are kind of, you know, they're used, oh yes, it's war, it's terrible, but they have no real image of what people live like.
So thank you. And also as a disclaimer, like sometimes it gets very personal to me, so also excuse some potential emotion there. But of course, I'm not on the ground, right? So I think also what I will tell you, it's not the first account. I can only tell it to you through the eyes of my parents and grandparents and friends. And there are, I think, two-folded answer to it. So it is really hard. It's like 4 years of war. It was the toughest winter that Ukraine has experienced. Russia has started to attack really essential civilian infrastructure like railroads, which was not the case in the first 4 years of the war. So people really, and there is no hope, right? So I think that's also what is really trading for people, that the hope that carried us on in the first year of the war is kind of evaporating. So it's really, really tough. And that's one part of the story. And of course, it's tragic. You hear about losses everywhere, every single day. It's just present in the news. But the second part of the story is that it's just impressive how people carry on. So this despair that I described, it doesn't let people pause for a second. People carry on. The society is extremely active. The civil society is just incredible what people and activists do there. And also just people build their like solar stations and generators and carry on their education. When I visit Ukraine, like to answer to your question, Stefan, when I went there after 3.5 years of not being there, in the summer, I went to the West Ukraine, to the mountains. And if you hypothetically would not know that there is war in this country, you would not notice. Because you come there and cafes are open, there is music on the streets, there are lively conversations, and it was more of a resort area, of course, where I went. But that was really just also impressive to see these two realities. Once you dive into this reality of cheerfulness, of course, you hear that everything people talk about is war. One way or another, how they're affected. There is really not a single person in this country who is not affected by this war. But they really find this humor is really a huge instrument of resilience that Ukrainians have, and it kind of helps us also in these dark times.
Yeah, and just to give an image, so I recently had for my family to make a little guideline how to live in a high rise without canalization when there's no water. Can imagine you can't use the toilet. What does it do to an old woman who lives on the 12th floor who can't use the toilet? So it's really so the survival is on another level. Many people are telling me, oh, you know, I come home in my thick jacket, in my winter jacket, and I sit on the couch for a bit. They don't watch TV because there is no electricity. There's no power. And then I go to bed and I don't even take off the jacket because it's really cold in the flats that have no heating. But everyone knows someone who has heating. Everyone knows someone who has power. Everyone knows someone who has eggs or a generator or something. And I think these networks really grew together over the past 4 years and in the East even before that. So what I'm very interested in is we are watching Ukrainians not only survive, but keep humor and solidarity. And I wonder, you work with European young people. How can we teach this kind of resilience? Where is it born? How is it fed? And can it be contagious?
So I think yes to all of your questions, and maybe also to the examples of toughness that you said. Another like reality check anecdote is like, for example, usage of ATMs. People have cash now these days because like electricity is not there. You have to adapt on every single level, or like traffic lights do not work. So people have to self-organize every single possible of their lives, which I find also just impressive. And the challenge is unimaginable. I think the biggest value that we do in our work in EVP, but any other youth work, is really to bring these young people together. So we recently had, and actually our flagship program on Ukraine is Rebuild Ukraine Ambassadors, also with a big support of the E.ON Foundation. And last year we brought, actually in the first year of the war, we already saw how resilient young people, they're really 16, 17-year-olds who had to also be in bomb shelters. They had to play games in these bomb shelters, and they still had this hybrid event from Lviv and Warsaw where we put them together and connected. And this connectedness where, and then last year, we brought them to Lviv for a study trip. So we brought a group of 15 young Europeans to Ukraine to kind of show them what their life in Ukraine is like. And the accounts we've heard were really like probably beyond what we expected. But everyone said that what we read about Ukraine or even hear from Ukrainians, but not seeing it, was like very hypothetical. But then you come there and you see how people, young people, work 24/7 for the best of their society, how you could really see how they fight literally for Ukraine, for freedom, for Europe, for European values. And I think this is where this exchange is most valuable. And I think in that sense, also, you now hear it a lot in the news. What can we learn from Ukraine? But the first-hand learning is really by going to Ukraine and seeing it in action, or exchanging with Ukrainians who unfortunately also happen to be in Germany now in many numbers. So that's where you learn.
I still remember this, this gathering we had in Warsaw and Zoom connection to, I think it was in Lviv, and it really impressed me and touched me, this situation. So the special situation with the bomb alarm, but also the same level of communications we had. So we just discussed issues. So it was like in exchange of ideas between young persons, between professionals. So and this showed on the one hand how so that we are on an equal level. It depends where you are in Europe, the coordinate system. And we were in Warsaw at this time. It also changed not only our perspective on the Ukraine, but also our perspective on the cooperation with our Polish colleagues who were also involved, because we learned that they are geographically much closer to Ukraine and also in terms of emotions much closer. So I remember my colleague Alexandra Smyczynska's speech about the children which were hitchhiked from Ukraine and deported to Russia, and it was really emotional. So it showed so that this what so it sounds a little bit pathetic, so that this exchange between different European countries can be so fruitful, and this is for me the value of this Ukraine project. And maybe so one question a little bit broader about the EYP, regardless this special Rebuild Ukraine program, so what is the impact of involving people from Ukraine into the EYP's work in general? So, I mean, you are the boss, but there are much more, I guess.
So the big impact is really that Ukraine is Europe, or Turkey is Europe, or Georgia is Europe, you know. So all of these countries, and of course our steel framework of reference is Council of Europe, but that I think is the biggest value. But of course it's also not only EU is Europe. I think that's actually the main kind of reference we have. And of course, the biggest value of this project, and we have also a similar project, for example, about the Arctic. You know, how often does a normal European think about the Arctic in their daily life? Not so often. But the value of the work we have is to really bring these topics and regions together. So in an example of Ukraine, we bring ideas of young people on the future of Ukraine to first send a message that it matters now what young people think. They will live in Ukraine, or they will live in Europe, which is as the country that's affected by war, and what they can do now, and the decision makers. And that's, of course, what we really try to reach, that we bring those young voices to the ears of all the decision makers, also to someone like you, Stefan, who have heard it, seen this passion, and you also know it now firsthand, that this exchange matters, and it's not just like for fun that we do it. So that I think is the same with the Arctic, for example. We bring the Arctic participants, which also are affected by the security issues these days, to Europe, and Europe to the Arctic. And through this exchange, everyone relates more to what this region needs, what is on the mind of young people from there or here.
I have a second thought. I think it's vitally important to connect young people all over Europe. I actually worked in a similar project with my project Aula, where we connected 14 countries and had the youths exchange ideas around their communal projects, which was wonderful. But also, I think something happened in Ukraine due to the war, but also due to the repression before that, that I have witnessed on Maidan. I was there, and what fascinated me was how people, we had this saying, if a trash can breaks in our backyard, we have to call the president, because the country was so centralized, and because there was no such thing as self-reliance or self-efficacy, especially in the more, you know, Soviet style cities. And how these people who were raised in that self-organized a place where 30,000 people lived, and they had warm food there with people who helped, and they had medical centers and an open university and arts programs and so on. And all was free and all was open. And they did that under threat from the police. And I watched that, how they cleaned. They actually took brooms to the place and cleaned it two times a week. And I thought, why? What? How? And then it occurred to me, this was their place. They had ownership, and they took ownership of the country, and they took ownership. For them, the idea of Europe, of being Western, was democracy, and democracy for them was the idea of ownership. This is our place, and it's not a corrupt politician's place. So when I look at youths who have lost trust in institutions, I understand that very much, because there's only like two ways to trust an institution. Either the institution cares for you, like a parent, like you are a customer, and if the institution is a good store, then you continue shopping there. And that's how Western Germany was run, and I think how much of the West is run. But this trust in institutions fades as soon as things are starting to get worse. And for youths around the world, now life is getting worse than it was before. The second way to have trust in an institution is if it's your institution, if you feel ownership. So I think the project that you're doing, Anya, it goes beyond connection between young people. But when you connect them in a parliament, you give them self-efficacy. You give them this belief that they can do something, and then something changes in the world. And that gives them ownership. And this ownership translates to this incredible resilience, but also responsibility and care for one another. Would you agree with that?
I think you actually described it better, as if you're doing my job, so you know it better than I. But it's really that the value of the work we do is really to give this agency and the tools to young people, and to really equip them, in some cases for the first time in their lives, with the idea that their voice matters, that people listen to them, and that they could make a difference. And of course, with the Maidan as an example, it was entirely initiated by young people as well, young Ukrainians, and then the society joined in. So I was also a student at the time and joined the, well, actually I was not a student anymore, but doesn't matter. I was a young person, so I also joined the protests, and it was really, as you described, was impressive to see. And I think a very important point of a history, of course, to also see how the society could influence the direction and the development of the events.
May I ask one additional question about that? I understand this point you made, Marina, and you confirmed, Anya, about this ownership and shaping one's own future and so on and so forth. Is there still a conflict between different generations? So I understand the role of the younger generation, the role now currently, but also on connected with the Maidan protests. So is there a different perspective on all that, on institutions, and from the older generation? So is it possible to understand and to answer this question?
I think it's the same probably in the German society, in each society. It's always a generational conflict. It's inherent, I think, in any time. In Ukraine now, I think, of course, opinions matter. When it comes to the war, I think it really united the country. So it's very clear, it's black and white. And of course, like you might have heard that last summer, there was this anti-corruption protest also by students in Ukraine. And there, I think there was a bit of a shift, because it was really predominantly young people going to these protests, and a lot of older people were a bit more trying to create trouble, just like, let's focus on one problem, which is the war, so why do you now have to bring this problem in? And I'm just generalizing. So there was a bit of an intergenerational conflict there. But what you said, with institutions and maybe the role that a citizen plays, but overall, around the world, I think it's relatively unified.
I think that the Maidan itself was very generationally mixed. Like, it was started by young people. By the way, that's something we see all over Europe. When we look to other countries, Serbia and so on, it started by young people, mostly by young, well-educated people, which is why fascists and authoritarians hate education. But old people absolutely joined in. What you do have, and you have that among old people especially, but also among young people, is people who have some kind of weird nostalgia for the Soviet Union, and who start, you know, and they are just, they don't trust this ownership thing, and they feel, in psychology, we call that learned helplessness. Like, when you for a long while were not able to decide on things, then you don't have the motivation because you know it would frustrate you. So you don't develop the motivation. And I think that's what's going on with a lot of older people who are from rather authoritarian societies.
I mean, I only lived for 1 year in the Soviet Union, or 1.5 to be exact, but of course, you grow up in a very Soviet mindset, right? So nobody canceled what my parents experienced or my grandparents. And my grandfather is a party soldier, you know, so he still believes that being a member of the Communist Party is his best life experience. And I think, of course, it's also because you can't cancel the youth of these people and some of the beautiful days they've had. And there, I don't know if I would agree that they would really not see this ownership, because what I see that the older generation in Ukraine, they admire young people. They really truly see that, and they're happy that the future of Ukraine. But of course, there is also, as I said, I think there is a bit of this point of hopelessness that people also see that they don't want their children to grow up in the war. They don't want their sons to go and to die in the war. And there, what is the cost of democracy, actually? And, you know, and there maybe this nostalgia even comes back in a stronger wave.
Yeah, interesting. So you mentioned your grandparents or your grandfather. So you told me about them. They also came or flew from the Ukraine to Germany, and they spent some time here in Germany. Do you want to talk about that, how they felt far from... you are, as a younger person, maybe you are more adaptive to such situations. How was that step? How did it feel for your grandparents? And they are back, I guess, I learned now, to Ukraine.
Yeah, so that also coming back to the very first introduction, Stefan, that you gave about Chernihiv and how the situation was, that sadly, that's maybe now, since the war, people know about the city, because it was not so much on the map of people's minds, because it was very much in the news. It was really a city that was kind of circled in, and it was really hard to get out, and the troops entered through Belarus, through Chernihiv, to go to Kiev in this like blitzkrieg mentality that was there in the first weeks. So it was a proper evacuation of my family. It's a lot of risks. And then that was my parents, my grandparents, my cousins, my sister who came. My grandparents, it was the first time abroad, first time further than, I don't know, 300 kilometers away from where they are. And they were 85 at the time. So it was very uncomfortable for them to be away from their soil. That's a literal translation, what they said. And fortunately, they went to a village in Brandenburg, so it was more comparable to their experience in a village in Ukraine. And of course, there I could just say how warmly they were welcomed. So it was all the stereotypes we have about certain of Germany, the welcome that my family received was extremely generous. So with the help they offered, with just smiling and everything that was there. So like a neighbor gave chickens to my grandma so that she has something to attend to. But they were not at home. And that, I think, is something that I've noticed is a strong misconception of a lot of political debates that happens in Germany in this immigration. That, I mean, none of my family members and none of or many other Ukrainians, nobody actually wants to actively be here. But once they are here, they want to actively build a good life here. But the moment they can, like my grandparents, they left after 6 months. My parents left after 2 years. They would go back because their home is Ukraine. And that, I think, is just something that you will never be able to give to people. And I had a very easy immigration story, if you will. I came here at 24, I studied and got my master's, I married, I speak German, I'm educated, I have a job. So it's like, but if you even think of my sister who came here in her late 30s, early 40s, it's really hard to build your life and then also not to feel welcome in that sense. Or in the beginning of the war, it was not the case. So So that's, I think, is a very long answer to a question about experience of my own family. So my grandfather will turn 90 this year, so I hope to go to his birthday. And his favorite, like really, for the last 4 years, all he can talk about is his life in Germany, because he has such positive memories about it. So he always says that he wishes it didn't happen to him. And of course, his story is tragic. He was born during the war. And yeah, let's see when the war is over now in Ukraine. So,
Anya, thank you very much for sharing this story with us and our audience, because it has so many layers. And so it's so personal on the one hand, and it's so like generic about, let's call it migration or moving from one place to another, and the experiences you make in such a detailed manner. So I really appreciate that very much. So before we turn to more like professional topics, so that you are sharing that with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for listening.
Marina, so should we turn a little bit more, a little bit, maybe our listeners are also curious about the topic, what we can learn from Ukraine, and about this Rebuild Ukraine Ambassador Program. So you've already mentioned in our conversation. It's not only like Teams calls and trips to Lviv and so on and so forth. It's also hard work on conceptualizing, rebuilding Ukraine in a sustainable manner. So this is, I think this is a clue. This is a nucleus of the program. Maybe you can tell a little bit more about that. So, because I mean, there are many papers that were written, so substantial ones. Maybe you can explain it a little bit more.
So, Rebuild Ukraine Ambassadors Program. We have it now since 4 years, and also thanks to Stefan, I think you were also very much in initiating kind of the idea there, right? So conceptualizing it from the very beginning, and then we took it from you with your help. And there the idea is that it's a group of Europeans, but half of them are Ukrainians, come together and they think together how to reconstruct Ukraine. And I've mentioned it already, but the idea is that they think about it now so that we are ready to do it when the time comes. And what I think is very interesting also in terms of, I guess, like energy and climate and all of it, also culture, everything is viewed through the eyes of democracy, security, and resilience. So if you think, for example, of energy infrastructure, everything that these young people discuss, it's never, or we need to rebuild, but it's viewed as a huge opportunity. So it's not viewed as a supply, right? So energy is not now just looked as a supply to the country. It's viewed as an essential security asset. And how to transform it all sustainably and in a resilient way. I had to kind of reread the papers before the podcast, and I was again impressed how forward-looking the ideas are. So like they talk about what local communities need to do, what citizens need to do, how the financing needs to happen, what the education level needs to be. And it's very much viewed as an opportunity eventually, even though we have to start from scratch in many areas, but why not to do the most innovative, the most green system that is yet to exist? And that's what this program is about. And I think what also, I put down also a quote from one of our European participants who went to Ukraine. And he said that, like, you look at Ukraine now through the lens of geopolitical struggle and like this war. That's all on your mind. But once you meet a fellow Ukrainian, like young, go to Ukraine, you understand that the society functions. Like the daily business is not interrupted. You know, you want to go to a shop, you could go. You need to apply for a new passport, you do. So bureaucracy, democracy, the institutions, everything is there. And this is, I think, also was like an interesting exchange element that we introduced last year to show that actually it is a functioning country. Even in the state of war, it functions just as well, if not better.
And I think you make a good point. In Germany, there is a little discussion about how Ukraine could actually catch up to Europe, or rather, develop even further without catching up, like overtake without catching up, because they are so needed right now in war technology, right? They have the drone capacities, they have innovative technology. But I wonder if we speak about the elephant in the room, which is energy, because this war, as well as many wars we are facing right now, are all about fossil energy. Of course, nobody can appreciate the quality of decentralized renewable energy networks like Ukraine. Do you think there's potential there? Do you see developments where, when the war is over, when Ukraine starts rebuilding and many of the old heavy industries have died, and I'm afraid much of the agricultural industry has died, at least for a while, Ukraine has to go somewhere, and the probable way is technology. Could Ukraine become like a front runner in renewable energy?
I can also tell you what young people think and what they think, that we really have to avoid rebuilding the old infrastructure, this outdated carbon intensive systems. So we need to go for energy efficiency everywhere. We need to become efficient and, how to say it, independent critical infrastructure. So there has to be enough educational institutions, hospitals, which are all just isolated in their kind of energy cycle. And that's what they really see. And of course, in terms of what people can do, I mean, it has to be a transparent, uncorrupt financing there. If we can be ahead in the technology, of course we can. We showed that we can do it in the military sector, so why not in the energy? And of course, you could see that it is already happening. I think maybe just without a very like centralized planning. But if I think of like the village where my grandparents live, or like everyone actually I know in Ukraine, everyone has something which is renewable at the moment. Either it's a solar panel or some generator, or they just need to have it. They will not be able to survive if they didn't have it. And that's already happening. And you could see also that, for example, lots of Asian also producers are now aggressively present on the Ukrainian market with their renewable offers, maybe even more so than European producers.
So you're saying that probably China will take the lead in rebuilding the Ukraine, which would be such a great opportunity for European connection and for the European markets and for the economy. Are we going to be too slow again?
I don't know. I really can't say, but I'm just saying it what I observe.
Mm.
It's happening, yeah.
I think that's a very important point, because we are podcasting about energy. And I think it's such a vital point how connected authoritarianism is to fossil fuels, and how connected decentralized renewable energies are to democracies, just in the way they work and in the societies they allow to build. And I don't know if we have this topic on the forefront of our minds.
I don't know. But I could also tell you that, of course, for example, the rehabilitation centers that we also visited during the study visit with the Rebuild Ukraine ambassadors, it's a forefront kind of innovative center also with Proteza. What's a Proteza? But for a lot of also after-war disabilities that are there. And it's fully independent with its energy supply. And I think it's fully financed also by the EU grants. So there is also that happening. But, you know, the need is so huge. And also, of course, I don't have statistics at hand, but there was still some work calculated that the cost of the destroyed infrastructure, it's like in the billions. It's like... So, of course, it will not be perfect. And we will need support of everyone. It will not be just one country or one EU that can support us, support Ukraine.
If I may add a comment on that, it's a relevant idea. You mentioned Marina, and maybe Ukraine, so I understand you, Anya, the situation of a war gives us an offers us an additional argument for what you are talking about, Marina. So that we are not talking about decentralized energy supply and democracy as such, but as a basis for a resilient civil infrastructure that is also capable to be defended in war times. So, and we in the western part of Europe or Europe, we are starting discussing that right now, and we can build on the experiences from Ukraine. So this is a positive result from the situation in Ukraine. We really can develop into a democratic, like decentralized energy supply discourse in the rest of Europe. So, and we should do that. So it's like an additional argument.
Mm-hmm. And also, I'll do you one better. It's not only more resilient in war. If we weren't dependent on fossil fuels, there would be no war. So this war wouldn't happen because Germany didn't react when Russia annexed Crimea because we were dependent on Russian gas. Russia has the means in the first place because they are exporting fossil fuels.
I don't know if I can make a comment here. I think history doesn't have a conditional sense, right? So we don't know what and how could have happened. But energy resilience and independence is definitely a huge opportunity for Europe to embrace through Ukraine and then to import further.
Anya, I do have one, maybe not quite the last, but on questions. When you work in European projects with young people and in democratic projects with young people, what do you observe? Has it become easier? Has it become harder in the past few years, funding-wise, acknowledgement-wise, and so on?
Something to mention and what we noticed is really the effect of the pandemic on the young people. It's really called like this lockdown generation, and there are studies and research that proves that for this, like people who are in high school, first years of university, it has a huge impact. It's much wider impact than it had for any other generation, because it's really where your formative experience was kind of taken away from you. If you think of Ukraine, it's even worse. We're just out of pandemic and then 4 years of war started. So there is a generation from, I don't know, 12 to 18, who were for 6 years of their education, formative years, bomb shelters at home in their room in front of the screen. Like my cousin is 20 years old, and I think she did not, like in the last 6 years, she's been maybe in the school physically or university, maybe a few months collectively in this entire 6 years experience. And of course, it's something to be aware of, and Ukraine maybe is a specific example with the war, but also this pandemic. And of course, funding, I don't think it's just youth work. It's scarce everywhere in Europe, right? So it's also is American funding also for civil society being pulled out or priorities shifting in the governments. The competition is, it's really crazy. I could also give you examples of our grant writing to the EU, and the EU actually allocates more and more funds. But each single round we apply for a grant application is at least 20% more applicants. And the money can't just raise proportionally. And you could score the same, like there is a scoring system, and you could even score about the pass score and you would still not get a grant. So I think it's really, really hard to do work with little resources, but that's where I think EVP is a superb example of also resilience, because young people, they don't need much to do good work. You give them little, what we talked in the beginning about, you empower them, you give them agency and ownership, and they will do such great work. They just need to have these tools and space and this idea that they are heard and what they do matters.
That's such a good point. I think the Maybe even the less funding we have, the more we have the chance to develop ownership because we have to build things ourselves. Okay, so we can't afford catering for this event, then we'll do a potluck and everyone cooks and we have this raised sense of community. Maybe we need to attach tech projects like this more.
So of course, it's not the only needs we have. It's also, yeah.
But also, I think it's a good thing that we do have more competition because that means there's more projects. And
not necessarily. That's more like really where the funding priority. So that's a thing because, I mean, to give you an example from, again, Ukrainian context, USAID, so the American aid agency, they were probably 50% of the civil society came from there. And then, of course, once this huge funder pulls out the funds, it's not because there are more projects. It's just that the projects are fighting for less money. And before you could diversify. So, yeah.
I was in a round yesterday where some people who were doing the same work as I do in the German-speaking realm, and we again reiterated that it's so important for us to work together because when we get individual funding, a percentage of this funding goes back into the reporting and the handling of the funding, right? You have to do reporting and bureaucracy and so on. So when we work together, and when we exchange our strengths, not each organization has to fight on their own. And I think that's a new movement that we have to start, take more ownership over networking. And all the projects that work with young people, that connect young people, need to connect with each other. And yeah, that's also additional work. And we have to do a lot, like a lot. But I think it's a wonderful thing because we are not in the democratic space, in the progressive space, we are not really fighting against each other, right? We are fighting for the same thing. And it's important to take the time to network, to work together, to get to know each other because so many people are fighting at the exact same front. And that is something that gives me hope.
Agreed. Like, I agree. The more exchange we have, we are all in the we will never be at the point in civil society in our work where we could say, oh, we've done our job, let's move on to the next project. There is always work to do, and of course, yeah, let's do it together.
Very happy that the discussion about Ukraine stimulated a discussion about not only about funding but also about new forms of cooperation. So here you can see the case that we come from a particular example and go into more general questions of how we can make our contribution. I mean, I'm in a different, maybe I'm in a privileged position representing the E.ON Foundation because we are spending money on projects, we are funding projects, but we also have to learn and want to learn from those we are funding and we are helping with our money and with our maybe experiences. And we it's really an important task for us to understand what is going on in society, what is going on in, let's call it civil society, how maybe new alliances occur. So this is also interesting. So if the old alliances do not work anymore, we have to find new alliances. So it's really, I'm learning from this podcast discussions a lot. So, and I'm really happy that we had this topic on our agenda. And I'm really happy that we had you with us, Anya. So thank you very much for the discussion. And we always used to close our conversation with some bonus questions.
Verzweiflung und Hoffnung.
So we ask this question to every of our guests, and Marina, you have also talked about what gives you hope. So maybe I can ask this question to you, Anya. So considering the topic we were discussing, we have been discussing, what gives you hope in this context?
Young people and their ideas really give me hope.
Short answer.
And also just really Ukrainian civil society also gives me hope. I find it truly admirable what they managed to achieve with what we talked just a second ago, with so little resources. And so little resources everywhere, also like time to sleep. You know, you sleep in a bomb shelter, you wake up and you go on and you do your work and you have to do it. So everywhere you look, they can achieve so much more and they take a lot of inspiration.
Marina, do you want to add something? What gives hope to you?
Just getting hope from, in these podcasts, we always have such inspiring guests who do amazing work and who have their individual space and area where they fight. And that reminds me that we are all not fighting alone. What gives you hope, Stefan?
Briefly, I could say Ukraine gives me hope. And when I put it a little bit more detailed, I would say connecting political questions on a like very general abstract level to personal experiences and to find or define or to shape arenas for that, to make it really tangible. This gives me hope, since I think this is a way to spread the ideas we share to a broader audience. I mean, the audience we know, the bubbles we are active in, so there's a past understanding on many things. But if we want to reach broader audience, this combination of abstract political questions and like a personal approach and a personal need and a personal ownership, this gives me hope that it could work in the future.
Thank you. And thank you so much, Anya Supranenko, for being here and for sharing your personal experience as well as your professional experience in our work with European young people. And this was the 12th episode of Energie der Gesellschaft.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anya.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So, das war die 12. Folge Energie der Gesellschaft. Stefan, was hast du mitgenommen?
Am Ende gibt es immer so eine Frage, ob man noch aufmerksam zugehört hat und so. Was habe ich mitgenommen? Also ich möchte fast, oder sagen wir es mal so, ich war sicher, dass das Thema ganz viel hergibt. Also dass wir die richtige Frage stellen. Also die Kernfrage, was wir von der Ukraine lernen können. Das ist etwas, das hat super funktioniert und ich finde, Anja war da ein toller Gast, von der ich persönlich viel lernen konnte. Und ich hoffe, dass das unseren Hörern und Hörern auch so geht. Was mich wirklich sehr berührt hat, sind tatsächlich diese persönlichen Perspektiven, persönlichen Erfahrungen, sowohl aus der Arbeit als EYP-Direktorin, als auch aus der Situation in der ihrer Familie in Verbindung mit dem Krieg. Und ich bin wirklich immer sehr dankbar dafür und jetzt speziell sehr dankbar dafür, wenn Menschen so etwas mit uns teilen, weil ich wirklich glaube, das öffnet nochmal sozusagen, das ist wie so ein, ich weiß gar nicht, wie das, wie man das nennt, in so einem Workshop, so, das ist so ein Opener. Es ist fast bewusstseinserweiternd, dass man Dinge versteht, die man vorher nicht verstanden hat. Und heute habe ich ein bisschen das Gefühl, dass unser Podcast dazu beigetragen hat.
Ja, wir Menschen sind Geschichtenwesen und wir lernen aus Geschichten viel, viel besser als aus theoretischen Gesprächen. Für mich hat Anja diesen riesigen Bogen gespannt. Einerseits, was, also mit ihrer persönlichen Geschichte, was für krassen Herausforderungen die Ukraine gerade gegenübersteht, wie die Menschen davon belastet sind und gleichzeitig, wie sie damit zurechtkommen, wie sie Gemeinschaften bilden, wie sie humorvoll bleiben. Und das Gleiche wiederholt sich im Prinzip auf der Ebene von Jugendlichen in Europa. Wir sehen, einerseits sind Jugendliche in einer unikal belasteten Lage. Wir wissen, dass die Generation, die aktuelle junge Generation, so negativ in die Zukunft blickt wie noch nie zuvor, weil sie medial belastet sind, weil sie von der Pandemie traumatisiert sind, in der Ukraine nochmal speziell durch den Krieg. Und auf der anderen Seite beschreiben sich 50% aller Jugendlichen als politisch interessiert und sie tauschen sich aus. Und Anja hat uns erzählt, wie sie mit sehr wenig Mitteln sehr viel erreichen und wie alleine ihnen diesen Raum und diese Ownership zu geben, sie in die Lage versetzt, plötzlich selbst ganz aktiv zu werden und Neues über sich zu lernen und eine riesige Resilienz zu entwickeln. Das heißt, für mich geht aus dieser Folge hervor, wie nah diese Dinge beieinander sind, dass Entspanntheit und Ressourcenreichtum gar nicht unbedingt die Voraussetzung sind für hohe Effektivität. Es hilft, wenn man Ressourcen hat. Wir brauchen Ressourcen. Wir sollten der Ukraine und auch jungen Menschen Ressourcen zur Verfügung stellen. Aber es gibt eine menschliche Resilienz, eine Art Reservoir, auf das wir dann zugreifen, wenn es wirklich um was geht. Und ich glaube, auch das müssen wir stärker anzapfen. Das nehme ich so mit von heute.
Die Energie der Gesellschaft.
Da ist sie.
Da ist sie. Ja, toll. Also es hat großen Spaß gemacht. Es war sehr lehrreich und ich freue mich sehr auf die Folgen, die danach kommen. Ich freue mich, dass wir in diesem Jahr wieder in so einen Flow reingekommen sind mit unseren Podcast-Aufnahmen. Marina, das macht großen Spaß. An die Hörerinnen und Hörer gerichtet, bleibt uns verbunden. Überall da, wo es Podcasts gibt, findet man uns. Ist ganz einfach, die Energie der Gesellschaft als Suchbegriff eingeben, das funktioniert. Und wenn ihr Fragen oder Kommentare oder Wünsche habt zu der aktuellen Folge oder auch Wünsche zu Themen, die wir mal als Podcast-Folge aufnehmen können, wir sind ja mit unserem Thema sehr breit aufgestellt und andererseits sehr spezifisch, dann schreibt uns und wendet euch an uns. Wir sind über Social-Media-Kanäle erreichbar. Das würde uns freuen, denn wir wollen nicht nur senden, sondern auch in Dialog mit euch, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, treten.
Und wenn ihr ganz lieb seid und die Folge bewertet, dann machen wir die nächste Folge vielleicht auf Deutsch. Okay, dann bis zum nächsten Mal.
Ciao, macht's gut. Tschüss.
Die Energie der Gesellschaft wird präsentiert von der E.ON Foundation. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr uns abonniert. Hören könnt ihr uns überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt. Empfehlt uns weiter und lasst uns eine Bewertung da. So helft ihr uns, noch mehr Menschen zu erreichen.